Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The 21st century dial tone, the internet gurus say, is access to wireless broadband.
My sense is that we're not viewing broadband as actually infrastructure. We're still sort of viewing it as a basic connectivity or a luxury service. And so until we actually begin to incorporate broadband as a primary and important infrastructure, we're never going to solve any of the issues that we're continuing to debate here.
Ben Leonard of the New America Foundation isn't the only wonk who believes the federal government may be thinking way too small on its broadband initiative. For millions of people, the internet is still just a dirt road.
I'll take the dirt road. It's all I know.
Finding some pavement for when the rubber hits the road. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, March 16th, and The Takeaway is broadband for all. Is it like a constitutional right or just another jobs program?
That's a good question. Or, you know, I couldn't live without it, so I probably wouldn't live in a place that didn't have access. So
there
maybe
you
if you live there, you don't mind. Let's get right to the top stories. Dozens of officials from the FBI, the DEA, and other U.S. agencies have joined an investigation into the killings of three people tied to the U.S. embassy in the Mexican city of Juarez. Earlier, we spoke to Sarah Yana of the Christian Science Monitor, who's been in Juarez recently. She says one small business owner she spoke to was visited by drug gang members just before Christmas.
And then they showed up in December, basically with a gun, and said, listen, you have three options. You either pay, your place gets burned down, or you're dead.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is expected to visit Juarez today.
The FCC is expected to unveil its ambitious plan to bring high-speed internet service to millions of Americans who currently can't get it. It's going to also lower prices for 200 million current subscribers. We're joined now by Jed Kolko, an expert on technology policy at the Public Policy Institute of California. Good morning, Jed.
Good morning.
Is this a broadband-for-all policy coming out of the FCC? And if so, how much would it cost?
We're already moving in the direction of broadband-for-all. This plan would cost something in the range of $20 billion or a little bit more, with some plans for already how it might be funded.
Well, that's the price tag. We'll talk about the details in a moment. Jed Kolko, stay with us. We're also going to speak with a former chairman of the FCC.
In Afghanistan, we're learning this morning that the Afghan government was holding secret talks with the Taliban's number two, Mullah Baradar, when he was captured in Pakistan. Meanwhile, our partner, the New York Times, says General Stanley McChrystal, the top NATO commander in the country, has brought most of the special forces operations under his direct control for the first time. He says the move should help reduce civilian casualties.
We've got a new class of Hall of Fame musicians. Genesis, that kind of opera, sort of rock and roll band, fond of, well, you know who you are, you Genesis fans, but you're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, 25th annual Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Welcome, Genesis, reggae singer Jimmy Cliff, the Stooges from Detroit, the Hollies, and the Swedish pop act ABBA. But hey, you can never argue with ABBA. New economic numbers out last hour show housing construction fell nearly 6% in February. This after the strongest showing in over a year in January. A rebound in housing is critical to sustaining the overall economic recovery. Let's look at the markets now. Asian markets are down. European indices up. Futures are up. The Dow will get underway in about a half hour at 10,642. And we do expect a positive opening. The S&P will open at 1,150 and the NASDAQ at 2,362. We're going to take you to the South by Southwest Festival, bands that may eventually get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Jack Grace will join us a little later.
Coming up, how do you get through tough economic times? Well, maybe you should get some advice from people who have been through it before. We're going to get advice from our elders and some tips that you can check out at our website, thetakeaway.org. But if you've got some wisdom to impart, maybe there's something your parents taught you which still holds true today. Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll get more details about this first ever national broadband plan. Internet for everyone.
Well, let's get right to it. Celeste, you know, 50 years from today, we could look back on this day and say it was a huge moment in American history, or we could forget that it
ever
happened.
Or I'll be 90, so I would have probably forgotten everything.
That's right. But seriously, the potential is there. The Federal Communications Commission is unveiling today its first national broadband plan. It was promised when President Obama signed the stimulus package earlier this year. The idea: brings super-fast internet access to, internet access to every corner of the country. They've been ruminating over what this would actually mean at the FCC for more than a year now. 100 million Americans currently don't have access to broadband. Would that change under this proposal? We have two people to talk about it. Reed Hunt was the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission from 1993 to 1997. He's currently CEO of the nonprofit Coalition for Green Capital. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Reed Hunt.
Good morning.
And Jed Kolko remains with us. He's the Associate Director of Research at the Public Policy Institute of California. Jed, good morning once again.
Good morning.
So you said this would cost $20 billion. Would this actually constitute a broadband for all? And do you think broadband is a right in the sense that a dial tone is essentially a kind of right, or at least was during the 70s and 80s in the United States?
The plan has its very ambitious goal: broadband availability for essentially all households in the U.S., with very high-speed access for most of those households. Now, we've already been moving in that direction by the market itself and by last year's broadband stimulus. What this plan does is it pushes that goal to a higher level, as well as sets some specific recommendations for applications around broadband, like healthcare, education, and public safety.
All right, Reed Hunt, how would the regulatory scheme for something like this differ from what has traditionally been the role of the FCC, which licensed analog broadcast frequencies for traditional broadcasts, radio and television? What would the FCC need to do to control wireless broadband, which is, number one, digital? It's not sort of single-source transmission like television broadcasts. So give me a sense of the differences here.
Well, the Federal Communications Commission has been trying to make broadband the common medium of the United States basically since approximately 1994, when the Internet was first deployed widely as a commercial phenomenon. We happen to be this week celebrating the 25th anniversary of the first .com, the first website, but the deployment of the Internet it originally occurred, of course, because people were able to connect telephone lines to the back of computers without any charge. That's because the FCC said that the telephone companies weren't able to charge you for doing that. That's called narrowband, and that's the way that about two-thirds of all Americans connected to the Internet from 1994 all the way through to the early 2000s, and still a third of everybody who connects to the Internet uses a telephone line.
But you need a totally different
son of narrowband.
But you need a totally different regulatory scheme if you're not using telephone wires anymore.
No, you don't need a totally different regulatory scheme. You need to much more expansively pursue the path that the FCC has been traveling for the last 15 years. The significance of this plan is that it is the first national comprehensive communications and media plan in the history of our country.
All right, let me get an assessment from Jed Kolko then. If that is the case, and if it is ambitious, as former FCC Chairman Reed Hunt says, what is the danger that this would just become a subsidy for some very profitable companies that are already Internet broadband suppliers and would be getting this $20 billion to add more wires, add more capacity?
The plan works both by a mix of regulations and incentives and subsidies, both for providers to expand their networks out to some underserved areas, and subsidies to households, similar to what we've had that subsidized households for the telephone service. The plan is actually designed to leverage a relatively small amount of money compared with what's likely needed from the private sector to make these investments in broadband, bringing very high-speed access to underserved areas. Is expensive to do. There were some who were actually hoping that the plan might have suggested much more federal money than is actually likely to come from it. And so I actually think of the plan as a fairly modest amount of money relative to what the ambitious goals are.
Mm-hmm. Reed Hunt, wouldn't it be more equitable to create a system where broadband was essentially free in the way that broadcast signals were available free to people? Wouldn't that deal with the digital divide problems we have in the United States?
Advertising had to pay for broadcasting, and there always has to be something that pays for the construction of any communications medium.
But in this particular case, poor people are going to have a harder time getting access than people who have the cash.
If you mean that it's easier to buy something if you have more money, I guess everybody in the world knows that particular experience. But the important thing here is to recognize that...
It's a fairly cynical dismissal.
The important thing here is to recognize that this plan is the cheapest jobs bill that you could possibly imagine. The plan is overwhelmingly funded by the companies in the communications media sector. And... for example, the kind of incentive they're going to be given under this plan is the opportunity to have twice as much wireless spectrum available for commercial development as currently exists. This is basically the same as an Oklahoma land rush for spectrum and will invite tremendous investment in.
Indeed.
It's worth just remembering that about one quarter of the 21 million new jobs created in the 1990s came from the information communications sector directly or indirectly, and this plan contemplates that a similar kind of job growth will well up from the new technological platforms that are rolled out that are called broadband.
Reed Hunt, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission from 93 to 1997. Jed Kolko, before we go, the analog broadcast spectrum is up for grabs in this bill, and the television networks aren't happy about it. What might analog broadcast be used for in this new internet age? Before we go.
So the couple of potential political controversies that arise from this are, first, the possible shift of spectrum from broadcast television to internet. The other is the possible shift of money that supports low-income household use of telephone service to broadband service.
And I could have my own TV station, even. That's possible here. Low power, anyway. Jed Kolko, Associate Director of Research at the Public Policy Institute of California, contemplating broadband for all if the FCC plan is as ambitious as they say. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
House Democrats are waiting to hear the precise costs of the health care overhaul bill that's expected from the Congressional Budget Office. Meanwhile, President Obama is meeting one-on-one with lawmakers to try and persuade them to vote for his plans. Economic news in the past few minutes, there's been a drop in housing construction following last month's blizzards in the Northeast and Midwest. The Commerce Department says construction of homes fell nearly 6% last month. That's slightly more than was expected.
Hundreds of Palestinians have hurled rocks at Israeli police in disputed East Jerusalem this morning. That's after Israel reopened a synagogue near one of Islam's holiest sites. Tensions have increased since Israel announced plans for new Jewish settler homes in East Jerusalem last week during that visit by Vice President Joseph Biden. A donor conference gets underway this morning in the Dominican Republic. It's for neighboring Haiti. The full reconstruction of Haiti has been costed out at $14 billion. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, speaking to relief workers, says the U.S. is playing a major role.
Haiti will be a priority so long as I am Secretary of State. And I know it will be one for all of you who have helped in the largest, most difficult humanitarian rescue and recovery effort we've ever attempted.
Here in the U.S., the heavy rain and wind that's pounded parts of the Northeast for the past 3 days is finally moving out. Cleanup from the storm isn't over, though. A photo on the front page of the New York Times this morning shows Little Falls, New Jersey, under several feet of water. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the story of an unlikely high school varsity football coach in Washington, D.C. A woman. It's a first. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen has the story next.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout is in the domain of sports, but it runs much wider than that. It's a story about gender, and it's also an interesting story about the coming of age for young men in high schools around the United States. On Friday, maybe you missed this, Coolidge High School's football team in Washington, D.C. got a new head coach. Natalie Randolph was hired as the head coach at Coolidge High School and is believed to be the only female in the United States to be coaching a high school varsity football team. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here with us. First of all, I was surprised that this is a first. I was actually surprised that this is the first time that's ever happened.
Well, one of the reasons that it's so rare is that one of the prerequisites for being a coach is actually having been a player.
Right.
So you understand the game, the nuance of the game, and there's not that many opportunities for women to play the game of football.
So what do you think of this decision?
Well, I mean, my initial thought was, like, this is good and this is a move forward. And another thought was that with the amount of young men in the urban areas that are growing up without fathers and father figures, the primary authority figure in their lives are women, their mothers, their aunts, their grandmothers. So from that perspective, I think this makes sense because you have a woman in an authority role. I think she'll be able to communicate with them in that sense.
So from the environment of Washington, D.C., as far as you're aware of it, this woman could have credibility that she might not have in other places around the United States.
Well, it's important that she actually has played football before. So she was a wide receiver in a women's football league. So she has that credibility. She was an athlete in college. She was a sprinter in college. So she understands the culture of athletics. And then she also was an assistant at the same school. So she's got a resume that says, okay, I can do this.
She knows the program.
Precisely. So yeah. that helps her out. And her relationship with the players seems like it's going to be fine. I think the challenge for her is going to be a relationship with the coaches and credibility with parents as well.
You know, what do young people who play high school varsity ball face? I mean, in a sense, it's tough on your body. It's an enormous time commitment, and there are enormous sort of risks in terms of your academic achievement as well. But there are enormous temptations if you actually are good enough to make it in the college game.
The core of what the value of a high school sports program is that it's a youth development program. Take away all the competition and all these different things about it. It's at the core, it is a youth development program. So her challenge is going to be, can she translate the lessons of real life and that come up on the football field? Can she translate how those lessons connect to the football field and to real life and help them to grow as human beings and as men?
What did your coach tell you in high school that helped you when you went away to Rhode Island, right?
So the last game that I played in high school, my junior year, we lost the state semifinal game to go to states, and we're crying. It's like a really tough moment, and our coach brought us together, and he said that in your grown-up life, you will face challenges much worse than this moment, and you will remember this moment almost as a joke because of what you'll face in the real world. And I remember thinking, wow, he didn't say anything about how we played. That was the first thing he said to us. And Coach Jack Berger from Troy, New York, was one of the most amazing coaches ever.
I got to give him a shout out. A little twinkle in the eye there. You see that? So Natalie Randolph, hired as head coach of Coolidge High School, you know, ought to be able to deliver those kinds of lessons. But let's get down to the sort of football details. She was a wide receiver when she played, right?
Yep.
Are wide receivers good coaches?
That's a funny question.
Or is it more the quarterback, or is it more maybe someone in the defensive side?
I think for the position that you want for a coach, that's an interesting point. A lineman is generally a good coach because they understand the grit of the game.
Right.
And so that's
the big picture.
Precisely. And so my that part of it, I think, I will wonder, she be able to understand what those linemen are going to have to deal with.
Wide receivers have got a little ego issue, right? Don't they, maybe a little bit?
The wide receivers see things from this other perspective outside of, they see the edges of things.
Right.
So I don't know if they get into the muck and the grime of the game. So that's where, you know, the real grittiness of football, I'm not sure if she's going to get that.
And, you know, what's Coolidge's record? I mean, are they a power team? Are they someone that, where there's a lot riding on this, kind of like a Notre Dame?
They're a mediocre team from their record, but also their school has been taken over by a private firm outside of D.C. So I think there's a lot of issues here that kind of collide. This is an experiment, and I think it's going to work well. I think she has the temperament to do it. She's almost like a Jackie Robinson temperament.
Yeah.
She's going to, from all accounts, she's going to face the challenge and face it well. And I think maybe this will open the door for other people to see that women can coach at this level.
I think we should send Ibrahim down there to report on that.
Absolutely.
I would love to go meet her.
All right, we will do that. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for our last takeout, we go to our listeners. We want you to check in on the news and stories with us. And one of the things that still has you talking is our question to you of what do you think Haiti needs from the world right now?
What Haiti needs right now is jobs.
To develop strict building codes.
We are just pouring good money after bad.
The primary need is truly shelter.
Only one thing Haiti needs is help and cooperation in Haiti.
We also got some great responses up on our website. You can weigh in with other people. That's at thetakeaway.org.
We're getting more stories from you as we track the census. We talked yesterday about how some cities are actually shrinking and asked for stories from you on why your town might be one of those shrinking cities. Tina posted to our site, I've lived in Hollywood, Florida since 1957. Now, a lot of the empty houses I see are a testament to the fact that we're unable to afford living here. In the not-distant future, only the wealthy will be able to live here, and the future is very close. Just about everyone I speak to agrees and are looking for a way to get out. Cost of living here and owning property is becoming unsustainable. Peter writes to us on our Facebook page, keep an eye on Miami. Things are going to get bad fiscally, and I predict an exodus as city services go to crap and businesses close under new city fees. Doesn't sound like things are great in Florida for them, but what about your city? Keep your stories coming because we want to track what your hometown is like, maybe even come back to you as we talk more about the census. Make our own census map here at The Takeaway. That's at 8778-MY-TAKE or on our site, thetakeaway.org.
Another thing that we want from you is your slogan, 6 words or less. Give us anything, a 6-word phrase on anything from politics, culture, your life, your dog, beginning April 12th. You can vote for your favorite at our website, and if you're one of the top 5 winners, we will make your T-shirt with your slogan on it. Here's some samples of what we've already gotten.
It's still better than John McCain.
We also got fund social programs, tax all tweets. And then we have WWJD, what would Jeter do? And Ibrahim can appreciate.
Ibrahim loves that one, yeah.
Fewer carbs, the change we need, KNEAD. Ooh. And totally connected with nothing to say. Give us yours at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, trying to drum up support for the health care overhaul bill on the House. And the person responsible for doing that, Democratic House Majority Whip, whipping up support, James Clyburn. He's the one responsible for getting those votes through the gate. We're going to talk to him about how he's doing that in just a few minutes. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Dozens of officials from the FBI, the DEA, and other U.S. agencies have joined an investigation into the killings of 3 people tied to the U.S. Embassy in the Mexican city of Juarez. Earlier, we spoke to Jessica Pena, a sociology professor in Juarez. She says her family has been forced to change the way they live in order to avoid the violence in the city.
We do have to make, you know, a little bit of adjustments, like when dropping them to school or picking them up from school. We do have to be careful.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is expected to visit Juarez today.
Further signs of strained relations between the U.S. and Israel this morning. Special U.S. Envoy George Mitchell is now putting off a planned visit to the region. It all stems from disputes over increased Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem. Millions of people in Southern California shaken awake by an earthquake this morning. The magnitude 4.4 quake was centered about 10 miles east of downtown Los Angeles. Happened just after 4 a.m. Pacific time. No reports of serious damage, but it did jolt people. Here in the Northeast, the governors of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut have all declared states of emergency because of flooding. The states have been battered by storms the past few days that have toppled trees, flooded roads, and left at least 9 dead. The Federal Reserve has begun a meeting that's expected to focus on when it will raise record low interest rates. The rates aren't expected to go up today, but eventually, Fed policymakers will need to start bumping them up to head off inflation, and that, of course, will affect the markets. Markets always try to anticipate interest rate changes. Let's see what's happening on the markets. Wall Street is open this morning. Futures were up all morning, and the Dow is up about 16 points. The Nasdaq, 5 and change, and the S&P is up just about 3 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
President Obama is stumping hard for health care.
So, look, Ohio, that's the proposal. And I believe Congress owes the American people a final up or down vote.
Well, the president has said he's going to sit down and meet with many members of Congress face to face. And there's one other guy that's going to be doing that to try and get those votes together. It's House Majority Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina. It's his job to count the yeas and the nays for the Democratic Party. Congressman Clyburn, good morning.
Good morning.
On Sunday, you were on Meet the Press. You said you did not have the votes to pass health care reform. So 2 days later, are you a little closer to that magic number?
Yes, we are. But we aren't there yet. And I think that there are a few things that we have to be careful of and wait to see happen. And so we can be clear with our members as to exactly what it is they're voting for. We still have not gotten final numbers from CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, to let us know exactly what the thing is going to cost and what the savings are. And until we get all of that, we will not ask those undecided members to give us hard commitments, and so we're waiting on that.
Okay, but there's not all of the people who are holding out on their votes because of cost of the bill. There are those who have other issues with it. Can you give me a rundown kind of those who are maybe standing off to the sidelines, not giving you a yes vote yet? What are their complaints with the bill?
Well, there are a couple of people on our side of the Capitol who feel that they can't go with anything except a single-payer plan. Others feel that the public option ought to be in there, which is something a little bit short of a single-payer. There are other people who wonder whether or not the abortion language is to their satisfaction. There are a plethora of things that people are concerned about, and it all depends upon what region of the country they're from, as to whether or not they think the regional disparities that have been adequately dealt with. So there are a lot of things here that we have to get people comfortable with, and we're still working.
Okay, so since you're speaking about regional concerns, let me play you this clip, Representative Clyburn, of President Obama, when he's talking about how politics are kind of getting in the way.
And now as we get closer to the vote, there is a lot of hand-wringing going on. We hear a lot of people in Washington talking about politics, talking about what this means in November, talking about the poll numbers for Democrats and Republicans.
So he's saying that that's a bad thing, but this is what you deal with every single day. You're dealing with people who are concerned about re-election campaigns in November.
Well, that's quite true. Those are individual cases. But the fact of the matter is our caucus really feel that the American people ought to have universal access to health care. Now, that is a very strong feeling in our caucus. And there are some of us who believe that that's more important than any individual's reelection. And so working collectively, we are going to try and get the 216 votes that are necessary, because this is something that we have gotten very close to. That's been many administrations have tried for almost 100 years. And we believe that time has now arrived for us to have all of our working men and women covered by health care.
Okay, but that can't be a popular thing. Let me ask you yourself, is your reelection, if your constituents had told you they would not reelect you if you voted for this health care proposal, would you still back it if you were going to lose your job in Congress?
Well, I think I would. I'm not sure that I would. And it all depends on whether this was my first term or where I am now in my ninth term. A lot of these factors. But I hear from enough people about the individual aspects of this bill to make me certain that nobody wants a child of theirs born with diabetes not to be able to have health insurance. Nobody wants to have their insurance company sending them a letter telling them they're no longer covered as soon as they get a catastrophic illness. I believe that every child that finishes, or young man or woman finishes college and decides I want to go to medical school or to dental school or law school, and they're told if you do so, you won't have insurance, because at 21, you're off your parents' policies, and if you aren't working, you don't have insurance.
Well,
these
mentioned
things that people want out of their lives, and I think that when you talk to people about this and make it personal to them, you can overcome that.
Congressman, you mentioned the kids in college. $70 billion college financing bill was added to this bill here, I suspect, in an effort to get progressives to find this vote much more palatable. Do you think it's working based on the kind of work you're doing?
No, sir. That's not why we did it. We did it because the budget resolution a year ago mandated that education and health care had to be a part of reconciliation. And in order to get us to where we need to be on the deficit reductions that come with the reconciliation bill, we had to add the education thing to it, as we mandated a year ago.
Is that gaining you votes or losing you votes, putting them together like
well,
that?
Well, I know of one or two votes that have now decided they may not go with us because of it, but I think there may be three or four that decided this is good for them.
Well, we'll have to see if you get that magic number of votes in time to meet President Obama's deadline. He says he wants that bill this week. James Clyburn, get back to work. The House Majority Whip and Democratic Congressman from South Carolina, thanks so much.
Coming up, we'll take you to the epicenter of all that is new and exciting in music, checking out the South by Southwest Festival with Jack Grace, our music buddy, later on this hour. And on our website, we have some advice for anyone facing unemployment or financial hard times from the dad of our work correspondent, Beth Koblenner. We've posted his tips online, but we want yours, too. What financial lesson from your elders is helping you right now?
This is Dennis from Detroit. My old man used to say, if you work hard, you may not always get what you want, but you'll always have what you need.
This is John from Fort Lewis, Washington. My dad always told me to not borrow money from anybody.
That's great. More tips from old-timers and you, and young whippersnappers can call as well. 877-8MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org.
Pictures can absolutely make a difference. That's what photojournalism is. Strong images of historical events do have an impact on society.
It's the voice there of Charles Moore speaking in 1995 in a documentary called Charles Moore, I Fight With My Camera. We lost Charles Moore this week. He died at the age of 79 at his home near West Palm Beach, Florida. But his pictures did make a difference, and they will live on. Most of them, many of them, are indelible pieces of history that chronicle the civil rights movement in the United States. Joining me now is Hank Plibanoff, a co-author of the book The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. Hank, good morning.
Good morning to you.
You know, Charles Moore, you can see it in some of the pictures. You can tell he was the only one there and possibly the only white person who understood what was happening in America at the time he was clicking that shutter. How distinctive a photographer do you think he was?
Well, he was very unusual in that while, like many, he was Southern-born and raised under very Southern influences, he had a real mixture of influences over him, whether it was the loss of his mother when he was a young teenager, or a very open-minded father on issues of race, or his training as a fashion photographer, or generally just his intense interest as a former Marine to be where the action was. And so he always made sure that he got as close to the action as he possibly could.
Partly because he was trained as a boxer.
Well, he was. As a teenager, he had been bullied by some kids, and he didn't like that. And he joined up with Golden Gloves and took some training and fell under the influence of a coach who taught him to always, rather than just watch the feet, as many boxing coaches will teach you to watch the feet of your opponent, he was trained to watch the eyes, and which meant you got to get pretty close. And as a photographer, he insisted always on getting very close so he could see their eyes.
How much of a historical treasure are his photographs, in your view?
Well, when you think about what we would have lost, what we wouldn't have known, what the nation would not have known about the dehumanization of Jim Crow and the power of the struggle without his photographs, it's hard to even imagine the big gap in history that would have existed without Charles's photo.
And you don't have to see the photo to know the image. Dr. Martin Luther King getting arrested and roughed up by Montgomery, Alabama police at that famous rally. Civil rights marchers being attacked by those high-pressure fire hoses. I can see the image in my mind. What did he think of his own significance, Charles Moore?
Well, he was very modest about it. He was a soft-spoken guy, very modest. He didn't start out trying to change the world, but he began to see the influence that he had. He was proud of it in the end. He was proud of the influence that he was able to have. And again, just a very modest, soft-spoken man who had an outsized influence over the nation's thinking on race issues.
And he died at the age of 79 at his home near West Palm Beach, Florida, thanks to Hank Plibanoff, co-author of the book The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation, remembering the work of Charles Moore. We'll leave you with his voice once again.
For all journalists covering the civil rights story through the 60s, it was difficult, exhausting, and oftentimes very dangerous. For me, it was all of the above, plus troubling and emotional in a personal way, too, because I'm a Southerner, too.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee, and we both know that in the woods in the summer, deer ticks are something you avoid.
Way back when, they made me one of them, don't you know?
But not at the South by Southwest Festival, that's one of the bands, Deer Tick, that Jack Grace, our music buddy in Austin, is reporting on. Now, what to watch for at South by Southwest coming right up. First, here's a check on leading stories at coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. House Democrats waiting to hear the precise costs of the health care overhaul bill. It's expected from the Congressional Budget Office. Earlier, House Majority Whip James Clyburn told us the cost will help determine how many Democrats are going to vote for the bill.
And until we get all of that, we will not ask those undecided members to give us hard commitments. And so we're waiting on that.
Clyburn says there are still arguments about the public option and the language in the bill on abortion. A vote is expected later in the week. Overseas now, the South African President Jacob Zuma is making his first official trip to Zimbabwe. Zuma is trying to ease the deadlock between President Robert Mugabe and Zimbabwe's Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. The two signed a power-sharing agreement following disputed elections back in 2008.
Middle East envoy George Mitchell has postponed a visit to Israel following continued tension after Israel said it will build new homes in disputed East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, in the city today, Palestinian demonstrators and Israeli police have clashed after a synagogue was reopened near one of Islam's holiest sites. BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus has been following the story, and we asked him earlier just how serious the clashes are.
I don't think they're hugely serious in themselves today. Of course, the great fear is that out of a spark like this, some much larger event, something like a repeat or a revival of the Palestinian Intifada or uprising, could emerge. It only takes a small spark to do that. And of course, with no apparent progress on the diplomatic front, the concerns about what else might happen are that much greater.
Well, we're not going to get much progress on the diplomatic front from the U.S. side anyway if our envoy, George Mitchell, is postponing his visit there. Has Israel responded to that?
Well, the Israelis, no. I mean, the Israelis are expected to respond to President Obama's ultimatum, really. He wants them to do a wide number of things, and one assumes one of them is to rescind this decision to go ahead with building in East Jerusalem. Relations between Israel and the United States are at a very, very serious low at the moment. Some people are comparing it to a row back in the mid-1970s when Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State. Things are at a pretty low ebb, and I think it's clear that the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to, maneuver between the American administration on one hand and the more conservative elements of his own government, the religious ministers from the religious right and so on the other, is not working out very well. The Israelis have got themselves into a bit of a fix.
That was Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And finally, we all know this song. Michael Jackson's Thriller. Now our partner, the New York Times, reports there may be more Michael Jackson hits to come.
But, you know, he's...
He's actually dead.
Yeah.
Right. But
right.
He's not writing from the grave. They've discovered some previously unreleased material. They said the singer's estate has agreed to a multi-billion dollar deal with a music label Sony, worth up maybe $250 million. Could also mean the release of several new albums. That's some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
And it's a cloudy, rainy day in Austin, Texas. We're playing all the up-and-coming hits from the bands you need to know about. It's the South by Southwest Festival with takeaway music buddy Jack Grace. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm jealous of you. Listen. So, Jack Grace, who are we listening to here?
You are listening to a band from 1970 called Death. And Death was a band that basically is, some people consider, the father of punk music. All three band members, African-American, and they also claim that that was one of the reasons why they did not get into the mainstream.
Now, you chose this band to illustrate that the music industry is alive and well. How does this band illustrate that, and what are you seeing down at South by Southwest in Austin?
Well, it's not that, you know, the music industry is totally still happening. It's just that it's kind of poor right now. Maybe it could use a little more money. But this evidence that South by Southwest is paying attention to its roots, and they can pick out a band like Death and have all these people fascinated by it from of all different age groups, show that people still have a real serious interest in music of all different types.
Now, you're from Brooklyn, New York, and your band, maybe your band isn't down there, but I know you're doing some playing down there. What's the scene like?
My band is playing a bunch of shows down here, actually, and the scene right now is the best way to talk about it is what it was like changing flights in Dallas. When I changed flights in Dallas, there were so many instruments strapped on everybody. It looked like an infantry armed with clarinets and sousaphones and everything.
Oh, that sounds great. And what did you have? You had your guitar, right?
Yeah, I had my guitar, the wife had the bass, and then I have what's interesting about South by Southwest is there's so many musicians down here that I have a mariachi horn section that I use, and I did not have to fly anybody down because so many different bands had flown my horn people down that they were already all down here. Saved me some money.
All right, let's listen to this band. We actually heard a clip from them a little while ago, but let's hear something a little longer. A Deer Tick here.
Mm-hmm.
This is Baltimore Blues number one. It's from their album War Elephant. What do you like about this band?
I just like that they're real song-oriented, and they've got a beautiful sense of melody, and they're not. I just feel like they're not trying too hard, and they sound beautiful.
That's great. A lot of trying too hard bands at South by Southwest, yes?
There's no shortage, ever. For sure.
Well, let's listen to this for a second. All right, you know, South by Southwest is a place where you can hear music from all over the world. This is a band called Dengue Fever. Listen to this, and I want to ask you about it. Jack Grace, gotta love that Cambodian pop.
Yeah, we don't get enough Cambodian pop in the States, and that's a great example of some.
Do you like this band?
I do like the band, but I do find that if you go through their whole repertoire, they start sounding kind of similar when you hear a lot of it. But a little goes a long way, but I enjoy it.
All right, let's get back to your particular situation. Do you expect to get a record deal down there? Do you expect to make money, or do you expect to just have fun? And how many of your band members could you afford to fly down this time?
I afford, my wife is on base. That's who I flew down. The rest of the people, because there's so many different people, as I had said, I also have the honor of having Johnny Cash's piano players playing with me, who's based down in Austin.
Oh,
there's
nice.
So many unbelievable roots players down here
and
that
you can
use.
And you can just sort of get together and start a band right there at the festival. A lot of people do that.
There's no problem with being able. You could if you know people, you can pull together any sort of lineup you want right now. You mean if you want a string section, you got it.
All right, let's try a change of place here. Listen to this. Justin Townes Earl playing Halfway to Jackson from the album Midnight at the Movies. What do you like about this?
Well, you know, this is an interesting track that we picked because I haven't actually heard this track before, but I really like it because most of the times he's a vocalist. He's Steve Earle's son.
Right.
And he's really an unbelievable songwriter. I mean, he's got the talent, but even shows me right there in that example that the guy's also an instrument. You know, he can make good instrumental sounding music.
All right, well, how long are you down there for, Jack?
I am down here until Sunday, and I will be seeing many, many a thing. I'm trying to, my head is going to split open when I think about how many things I'm going to try to get in the next few days.
All right, well, bring me back some MP3s. We're going to go out on Freelance Whales. You want to tell me something about them?
Freelance Whales is your classic. That's the kind of band that you discover down in South By. They're not a lot of people know about them. They're a really fun, quirky band, and that's what South By Southwest is all about, is coming down here and discovering things you haven't seen.
And that's why we sent Jack Grace, friend of the Takeaway, to South By Southwest. We go out on Freelance Whales. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you very much. Have a good time. I know I will be.
We have a ton of stuff on our website, more about the South by Southwest Festival. You can also get some great advice for hard times on thetakeaway.org. Catch up on the conversation with how to survive troubled economic times with advice from your elders. We talked with the dad of our work correspondent, Beth Koebleiner. Harold Koebleiner has his 5 financial tips on how he survived the Great Depression. But we're also looking for your tips. What financial lesson did your parents or grandparents teach you that still holds true today? Give us some tips and get some tips at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can get a preview of the new series coming from Beth Koebleiner, the DIY Bailout. So the America's big banks, they got a bailout. And if you need one of your own, We start a 10-part weekly series tomorrow by talking about why money is such a hard subject to talk about between friends and family members and even among ourselves. Go to thetakeaway.org and take a look. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. Listen to that. Freelance Wales. There's hope for banjos. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.